Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, co-host of Locked Up Living, along with David Jones. And today we want to welcome along Geraldine Ackerman and Richard Shuker. I wonder, Geraldine and Richard, if you'd like to introduce yourselves for the listeners.
Yeah, so, my name's Geraldine Ackerman and I worked at HMP Glendon on aggregate for about 20 years. So I was there for one, then I left and went to another prison, and then I've come back there. So I've been back about 15, 16 years now. So I've worked as a senior forensic psychologist and as a therapy manager.
And apologies, I mispronounced your name then, so I'm okay.
No problem.
Richard?
Hi. I'm Richard Shuker. I have been at Glendon for marginally longer than Geraldine, which is a long time now. And I'm a chartered forensic psychologist, and I head up the clinical service at the therapeutic communities at Glendon, which I've done that for about 6 years. And before that, I was a psychologist on the one of the treatment wings, and I headed up the assessment unit for a period of time as well.
Thank you. Welcome on. And we were really keen to get you both on because you have been at Glendon for so long. And one of the things that David and I are really interested in was exploring how people manage to work within quite challenging, inhospitable perhaps environments, and manage to sustain their own sense of integrity and compassion and keep going doing the work without becoming cynical and jaded. Isn't that fair to say, David?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So in terms of you both having worked at Glendon for so long, we're really interested in exploring for the listeners what's so unique about Glendon. Some listeners might not know that much about therapeutic communities, so we thought it would be helpful if you could say a little bit about Glendon and the ethos there.
Well, I have a go first, Jerry, and then you can contradict me as we go along. So Glendon's been around for almost 60 years now. We've got a 60th birthday next year. What defines us? Well, I think there's a few things that I think really define us, and what we do is that we give people an opportunity to have a genuine involvement and participation in their own experiences of being locked up in prison, for which they are responsible for making decisions about what happens to them and others, and they are accountable for their behavior within an atmosphere of everybody working together to achieve something meaningful. And that meaningful thing is usually to make a difference in their own lives, and certainly in our men and our residents, a strong desire to change patterns of behaviour which have haunted them in some ways for many years. Jerry, you probably have a slightly different angle on what happens.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a very holistic sort of programme, so it does look at all aspects of the residents' behaviour. And I suppose when having worked in programmes and interventions in other prisons, you can tend to see someone for a couple of hours, two or three times a week, and they would be doing a group, an intervention or group, and then you wouldn't see them in between. And I suppose what's different in a therapeutic community is all aspects of the day are taken into account. So how they are outside of the group, how they respond to other people, to different members of staff, to different residents, how all of that's taken into account. So they really get to see and how they impact on other people. And I think that's a real big difference, because often if somebody does something wrong in a prison, they get taken away to a segregation and they don't see the impact of their behaviour. And lots of the residents would say in some ways they'd rather be taken away and not see the impact, because they do find it hard then to face up. And it might be a minor thing, it might be a fairly major thing, but seeing the impact they have on people on a day-to-day basis, just on their interactions, makes a big difference. And that gives us the opportunity to do that because we're with them all of the time.
Yeah, thank you. That's really interesting. You seem to be alluding to a sense of kind of power sharing within Glendon as well, between the two of you.
Yes, and I think that's probably power sharing across residents and the staff team.
Yes, I suppose that what I picked up from what you were both saying was a sense of trying to find ways to, I suppose, empower the people who live there to have more of a sense of sharing that with, you know, to take some control over their lives, not to be in control, but to try and find ways to share that.
Yeah, yes, I think that's probably a really important point. So for me, one of the things that really stood out in my first few weeks and still stands out for me is a sense of where you allow people to get to know each other in an atmosphere where there's, you know, a sense of respect and purpose. And the purpose is often, you know, achieving safety, achieving well-being, or even making changes to, you know, to people's lives, where people are able to do that in a sense of collaboration and where there's a sense of sort of shared goal. Yes, there will be an ethos where people work together to achieve something in a way which I haven't observed in previous places I'd worked. There's something very unique about the sense of collaboration and working together, which I think surprised me. It really surprised me when I first started working there, and that was one of the things that really sort of stood out for me.
And I think taking men to take responsibility for their, within the power as well. So if they make a decision, they sort of have to stand by that decision. So they learn a lot by making mistakes, as we all do. We all learn from our mistakes. And so they're very much responsible for running the wing in the way they elect someone to be the chair and the vice chair of the wing. And that person is quite a bridge between the staff and the residents. And so they would be a person that residents would turn to and also be a role model. So sometimes that feels a big responsibility and a lot of power. Some people feel ready for it and some people don't, but they usually grow within that position. But everything we get them to learn really is to prepare them for when they're outside. So this sort of struggle in power can be a big discussion we have. Often when we have peer reviewers come in, we're an accredited program. So we have people come and look at what we do on a regular basis. And so that will often be a thing that's discussed, is how is power shared, because it's not a thing that generally happens within a prison. And so we think about how is that different in Grendon and to what extent. And sometimes it can tip too far one way or another, but that's things we'd always be thinking about. Where is the power held within a community?
And you also highlighted something else really interesting there as well, Gerry, that when you referred to kind of like being able to make mistakes, because it seems as if so often in prison, there is an expectation that you have to get things right. Mm. And yet we all learn from mistakes that we make. And I suppose when you referred earlier to the not taking people to segregation, that allows for the opportunity to make mistakes, doesn't it? And to grow from that kind of learning.
Yeah, so we don't have a segregation area, which is obviously very unusual for prison. If the men have done something wrong, they either... they would generally withdraw themselves, but then come back and be accountable to the community for what they've done and why they've done it. But the idea of that is for them to learn from why they did it, rather than a punitive way of reacting in that way. So it's really for them to learn from it. So they would be thinking about why they made that decision. And it's a really helpful way that on any given day, you could just ask somebody, well, why did you just respond that way to that person when before someone asked you a similar thing and you responded differently? And people get that opportunity to learn so much about themselves on a single, every single day, staff as well as residents. You know, you can't help but learn a lot about yourself all the time.
So could you describe what a typical week for a resident at Grendon would be like, or at least prior to COVID? Because obviously things are very much different at the moment, I'm sure.
Things have changed during COVID. Prior to COVID, okay, so the week, I mean, the I think the ethos of people being heavily involved in decision making and involvement is what underpins therapy, as Gerry mentioned. So a lot of the week is structured activities, group meetings, of which allow residents to sort out difficulties, make plans, resolve conflicts, support each other. So how does that happen? Well, twice a week, there'd be a full wing meeting where you'd have, how many do we have? About sort of 40 to 45 residents on each community. Generally, we have a staff team where there may be 5 or 6 or 7 staff involved in the meetings. You've got to have 50 people in the same room, and the meeting looks at sort of exploring community life and decision making and assigning maybe voluntary roles to people. Everything is voted upon. The wee meeting would also be agendaed. It may involve looking at a dispute which could have occurred between residents. So these meetings, as Jerry says, are chaired by an elected chair and vice chair. And they really do form the backbone of community living, really important parts of what happens. Hard places to be, but really, really important parts of the week. Residents also take part in at Grendon 3 therapy groups a week. Therapy groups are also very, very important. It's I suppose the therapeutic model is a fairly eclectic approach. It does combine some interpersonal ideas, psychoanalytic ideas, and the therapeutic groups are very much exploring the sort of dynamic between early experiences and later patterns of behavior, and particularly how people's experiences of their related to their offending and past then mirror themselves in community living. So some of the problems that are sort of people experience in a TC are very much related to problems that they may have experienced throughout their lives. And in groups, that the group setting is looking at that, exploring it, making sense of it, and finding ways to change and help the patterns of behaviour. That's quite a lot of what happens in a week. Jerry, do you want to say a bit more about some of the other activities which are central sort of TC work?
Yeah, so we have additional therapies which are very core to the work we do. So they're mainly art therapy, psychodrama, and music therapy. And so they're available on different wings. So that is a different way of people accessing their emotions. Some people find it very difficult to sit in a group and just talk about it. Some people access it much better by doing a creative sort of therapy. So they're really central to the work we do. And then we also have lots of other opportunities, massive opportunities for people to have. We have regular events where the men could come and attend the events and learn from them, conferences, and often speak at them. And for most of the events we put on, when the residents speak, you know, that's taken much more seriously and taken a lot from more than when we speak. So we try not to speak at all. You know, the residents will go up and it's really from the heart. And I never cease to be amazed by how people can just stand up and speak so openly about their emotions and what they've learned and how much they've gained. And I have such respect, because if somebody asks me to get up and speak, I can very easily speak about a Grendon model or something else. If someone got up and said, can you speak about the most shameful thing you've ever done and tell what you've learned about yourself because of that to a group of strangers, I think I'd probably find that impossible. And yet the residents get up, and they're usually, it's a massive piece of therapy for them. Often they'll, so if they've decided they want to do this, they'll ask their group and the group will talk to them. Are you ready? Do you think you'll be able to? And what might you say? And then they'll usually on the day be really anxious. And quite often in an event like that, I'd be looking around to see who's the most anxious here today. And you can usually pick up on who that is, and you just sort of ground them a bit. And then they get up and speak and they're so proud of themselves afterwards, or they might, like we might come off and think, oh, I should have said this, or I didn't do that as well as I wanted to. But then they'll go back to their groups again and talk about the impact that had. And then when somebody else is coming along to do a similar thing, they'd be up, yeah, I did it. I felt really anxious, but I did it and I felt better. So they are really good role models for people coming forward. And as we know, with sort of Shad Maruna's work, if you people talk about, you know, the progress they've made and talk positively and confidently about themselves, that's really going to integrate into their being, which is what we're trying to get them to do. So again, I think it gives them so many opportunities for them to stand up and speak about themselves and the progress they've made. So we have family days, which is again another opportunity where the families come to the wing, and they're really moving days for everybody, because the families get to see where they live, where they have their groups, and how they sort of talk to the staff, have a whole day together, have a meal together. And sometimes they'll say, you know, they're so emotional days, the staff families will say, we haven't sat down for a meal together for years. Even outside we might not sit down for a meal together. And so they're really amazing days, very emotionally draining and tiring, but they're really powerful. And often the men talk about working towards them as a way of recharging their batteries, ready for back into therapy again, but they're very powerful days. And likewise, then each wing twice a year would have a social day. So to those, you'd invite sort of professional visitors. So it could be officers they've worked with before, offender managers, a whole range of people come. People have invited and the people have come, trial judges come, police officers, all sorts of people come. So, but again, they can talk about the progress, and the residents are really proud to talk about their progress. And for the person that maybe referred them to the prison or even sentenced them to prison, you know, they like to see the progress people make, because I don't think anybody would sentence someone to prison and want them to do badly. So they're really powerful days as well, in a very different way.
Your own pride and admiration as you talk about it, you know, you can sense the passion for the work that's being done there and the achievements of the men when they're there. And I think, you know, for many of the people that we work with in prison, they haven't had the opportunity to be successful at anything early on in life, have they? So I think it was something very powerful for them that they experience your pride and appreciation of what they've achieved. I think that must go a long way.
It is something I think they appreciate, but I think something that always surprises me about the therapeutic communities we have is that the sense of how far, and Geraldine was sort of referring to this, how keen they are to take part in their own process of imprisonment. They're really keen to organise these events, to, you know, do these things that Jerry was talking about. They'll set up an event looking at it, maybe what did we have last year, Jerry, victim awareness, for example, and they'll set it up, they'll organise it, they'll run it. Organized social events and so on, but the sense of wanting to take part and engage in their own sentence imprisonment always surprises me. You know, that the men residents we have don't tend to be those people who have always been the easiest to work with in prison. There's something about the sense of collaboration and hope and vision and purpose, the purpose to the experience that gets people really stuck in to. Just, you know, just being in prison and sorting things out. They want to make it work, and we're proud of it. They're also very proud, but they're also really proud of their achievements in a genuine way, you know, not in a sentimental way. They are proud of making a community a safe, vibrant, you know, hopeful place, and that is something somehow we're able to achieve as part of what we do.
Yeah, that's amazing when you think about how hard it is with some of the barriers that get faced. But mostly we do want to talk today about Grendon as usual, but it's hard to ignore the fact that everything that's going on is different inside right now due to the pandemic. So I'm sure the regime will have been really impacted by COVID restrictions. What are staff able to offer that retains the spirit of therapeutic communities under the current restrictions?
That's a very good question. What are we able to offer? I think we have to say, first of all, it's been a huge challenge. Maintaining an atmosphere of engagement, collaboration and involvement has been a real challenge. And I think it has tested us. What we've been able to achieve, I think, surprisingly, residents' behaviour has remained, on the whole, positive. Relationships with staff have also been tested, but residents will speak very highly of the interest and the support they've received. We don't want to gloss over any of the difficult things we've experienced, but I think we've also it's not always been easy to achieve this, but we've also maintained an element of resident involvement in what happens, the decision making, providing feedback for written feedback where there might be a sort of progress assessment of a fellow resident. They'll provide written feedback still. They'll still be involved in making decisions. But I think it has been difficult without having that forum for joint, you know, joint decision making, joint discussion, and so on. So I think it has been a challenge. But Jerry will say more about her experience, but residents on the whole, I think, value the support they have felt we've been able to provide them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they've really appreciated it. And at times, I think it tipped again. So in the beginning, we were all in it together. At the first lockdown, we were all locked down as well as they were, and they understood that. And But then I think when the lockdown restrictions were lifted outside, they felt a bit like, well, you're allowed to see your family and do things, but we're still not. So, you know, we were a bit behind in the prison by removing the restrictions a bit. But on the whole, most of them were. I mean, they might make comments and you think, well, that's fair enough, because I'd probably feel the same. So, you know, they were never that belligerent about it. But I think what was really interesting was the sort of shift in the way the staff team worked, because the majority of the time they were then spending with prison officers, and prison officers are the real backbone of our work. So all our group work, they're involved fully in every part of our work, but they were the ones that they were seeing more of than they were the non-uniform staff. And so they were sort of having to, in some ways, resist turning into a very restrictive regime and just being there and unlocking doors. And they were obviously under a lot of pressure as well with the anxiety they had from bringing COVID in or bringing COVID home. You know, everybody was under a massive amount of pressure and anxiety. But we used to talk about it a lot. And one of the things that came out on the assessment wing where I was working, we developed a newsletter, and it took some weeks to develop, but actually it was a real useful forum, and it became almost a replacement for the community meetings. The things we couldn't say together, we could say in the newsletter. And over the weeks, the residents got really involved in writing poems, and they had pseudonyms and would write things or write articles, or somebody might do a TV guide or somebody else might do a quiz. So it was a very community issue. And I used to do things on maybe on anxiety, how we manage anxiety, or maybe the trouble people might be having sleeping, or, you know, things that were happening outside. And we were sort of thinking, well, how do we help the residents to address this? Because we really missed our processes of having groups and wings where we'd be doing this naturally every day. So again, the residents were really, really creative in how we could replace that. And then as we started to open up a bit, as Richard said, they were still being talked to. There's chairs and vices. We were able to meet with the senior management team and discuss how we'd start to lift restrictions, what that might look like. So they were still very much involved in it. But it certainly was a very testing time.
I was going to say, it sounds like you've done really well in what must have been a very challenging year for you all, actually. Can I just ask a couple of things for clarification? While we've been doing this podcast, we've had to be fairly reflective about our own practice and the kinds of words that we use, particularly descriptive words. And I wonder what sort of words you use, particularly to describe colleagues and the men in your care. I've noticed you've used the word resident frequently. Is that the usual practice, would you say?
Yes, I think it is. It's had the discussion for many years, haven't we, Jerry Grunton, about the language, and our residents don't use the language of personality disorder. They don't like that language. They feel it's both labelling and also giving people a chance to avoid responsibility. It's an interesting feature that's always remained the same, and they don't like that. They don't like the language of diagnostic language. In terms of how we refer to residents, yes, I think that generally resident is a preferred term. I think the residents don't like it when they sense that we are trying to somehow describe them in ways that waters down their experience of being a prisoner or being an inmate, and they try to soften that. That lacks authenticity, they don't tend to like. Should we give an example about some of the work that we've tried to do to encourage people to view themselves in, should we say, more compassionate terms, other than a murderer or a rapist or whatever. We have tried in varying degrees of success to encourage people to use, I guess we might say, first person language and define themselves as an individual with other attributes rather than just an offender. Jerry, we've not always succeeded there, have we?
No, we haven't. And this is one of my crusades. So we always try to not use the word offender at all. But actually, they will often refer to themselves in that way. And as Richard said, we've tried over the years to get them to. So when a new person joins a community, they introduce themselves and the person. And I remember being struck by this when I moved from one wing to another. So I sit down and somebody said, oh, hello, you know, you're really welcome. It's nice to meet you. My name's John. And so you're smiling at them. And then they say, oh, I'm a rapist. And you think, oh, so then the next person introduced themselves. Yes. Oh, yeah, it's really nice. I'm glad you've come to work here. Yeah, my name's Peter and I'm a murderer. And that's how they would introduce themselves. And it's striking that that's all they'd introduce themselves by. So we would say to them, and since I've worked on the assessment wing, which is about 2.5 years, nearly 3 years now, we've come back to the community numerous times and said, you know, could we not introduce ourselves in a different way? But they are so resistant. And even on the assessment wing, it's almost like it's in the walls of the building. So it's not within the culture of the men, but that's what they want to do. They still want to introduce themselves by their offence. And so on the therapy wings, once people have been allocated to a wing, they have got more able to say, I'm a murderer, but also I'm a father or something else. So they don't like to drop that bit, but we've encourage them to say something positive about themselves as well and say, you know, what they're good at or what they like or what the hobbies might be, so that, you know, they're more holistic. But it's interesting what they say on the assessment wing is that they want to know who they're dealing with. So they want to know what people's offences are. And so that's their argument about why they've wanted it to continue. And I think that's often to do with the hierarchy of offences, which is obviously in prison. So Glendon is integrated in by offence type, so there's no sort of segregation of by offence type. And so people would come in and introduce themselves. So if somebody introduced himself and said, I'm in prison for rape, for some reason, everybody in the community would think, okay, now I know where you stand, where I stand. Whereas the same person might have been convicted of murder. And so they might say, I'm convicted of murder, and they might also be convicted of rape, but not say that. And so they see people very differently. And that's often what they want to know. They want to know, who am I dealing with here? And what they often find is if they have introduced themselves by another offence, or their main offence might not be a sexual, for instance, and then they get on with them and they get to know them, and then they find out later, they'll often feel really duped by that and get quite angry. You know, you didn't tell me that was your offence. So we're always trying to battle with that hierarchy of offences.
The other thing which has been interesting is, I think we mentioned this earlier on, a real sense that the experience has to be authentic and genuine. Mm. So I was part of a discussion with some residents who committed sexual offences, and about this issue about how they introduce themselves as a rapist or a sex offender. And they said, okay, hang on, you know, we get this idea about having a more, you know, helpful self, you know, identity, but it's the first time ever we've been able to introduce, say who we are, what we've done without a sense of shame, hiding things. Mm. We don't have to hide things here, which made me think, actually, because I, you know, like Jerry, felt it was somehow unhealthy to introduce myself to complete strangers sometimes by calling myself, you know, by my offence. The view of residents is that being able to be open and genuine and honest, really important, and not having to hide that or feel ashamed of it. Hence, the sort of view that being able to introduce yourself, talking about your identity as an offender, is in some sense can be helpful. And so, you know, that's the point of view. So that discussion will continue, no doubt.
That is an interesting perspective, isn't it? Because I would do recognise that in the men in the fens unit, that very similar dynamic where you feel people are kind of calcifying their offence into their identity. But I also hear what you're saying about the being able to be open and recognise that is just a part of you. So I wonder if the language is, I wonder whether, because you sound like you're very thoughtful about the language. And I suppose for me, a real bugbear is the language that's used throughout the system of feeding, shipping people out. It's all language of cattle, isn't it? And I'm guessing that that's different in Grendon as well, that you perhaps are more thoughtful about the language that gets used.
Yeah, I mean, we don't tend to talk about feeding because they come to dining room and feed and get their own food generally. But it's interesting, I never thought about shipping out because I think that is a term we still use. I hadn't really thought about that as being a term of cattle, but I think we would talk about maybe shipping people out. But again, we don't very often do that. So maybe, you know, that isn't a term I've thought about before.
We use a military term, return to unit, very, very militaristic.
Yeah, we use military terms. It's a whole different language in prisons, isn't it? But we do try to be very thoughtful about it and not just use words carelessly and get them to think about it as well.
Could you have these ongoing discussions about these things? And curiously enough, it was the word offender that Naomi and I had to have a discussion about as well.
Mm.
So something else that I wondered about a bit was your use of small groups. So am I right to understand that small groups would be used for the discussion of virtually anything? So from somebody's offence to their early life to traumatic experiences to what they've done in education or what they've done in the art group or whatever. Is that the nature of the small group?
Yes, I would say it is. It's interesting that we don't have a formal agenda necessarily for the small groups, but it seems to be almost inevitably residents want to explore not just their own behaviour, but also what's gone on in the lives of other people on their small group. So it might be, as you say, David, why somebody refused to go to work that morning. And that sense of really trying to get to grips with why somebody is behaving in a non-community minded spirit, why they are breaking rules, how that's linked to their, you know, offending, why that's linked to their has to their past. These things somehow almost inevitably become the material for discussion. And I've often wondered why that is. And I think it's because there's a real sense that what brings people, you know, how people end up behaving in the context of a community is very much sort of linked to some of their core issues regarding, you know, how they respond to threat or how they respond to boredom or how they respond to when there's conflict. And there's a sense of people wanting to work alongside each other to try to get to grips with A, where it comes from. The real sense is trying to understand where it comes from, what's it about, what motivates it, and a real interest in each other. So yeah, to answer your question, everything is processed and explored within these groups.
So in a way it's the crucible wherein the living learning experience of everyday life may be worked through and linked up with patterns of behaviour.
Yes, that's right. You know, there's two things which tend to happen. There's a real sense of support for when you have people living together in a community, you get to understand each other, get to understand a bit about their lives, a bit about their past. There's a real sense of wanting to support each other, which has always hugely impressed me. Extent to which people become genuinely interested in caring for each other, and part of that sort of care is also in people holding their peers accountable for what they've done, accountable for when they have, you know, made mistakes or when they have maybe lost their temper. But it's done in a way where there is mutual and genuine concern for each other.
Okay, thank you. Moving on a bit, both you and Geraldine, as you were saying earlier, have been at Crendon for around about 20 years. I think you a bit longer, Geraldine perhaps a little bit less. Do you think anything has changed over that time?
I'm often asked that question, has anything changed? I don't think that if somebody was at Crendon sort of 40 years ago, came and sat in a small group or wing meeting now, they would see anything particularly different. I think they'd see the interest. I think they'd see a real sense of ownership, a real sense of pride. They'd see some really genuine and authentic exploration of what's going on in the here and now. They would observe that. They would see the care, the concern. They'd see the interest that our staff, our prison officers have for the residents. There probably are some things that have changed. I wonder if I'm oblivious to those. I wonder if things are... So in my experience, not a lot has changed, no. I think there's always in my experience at Grendon, there's always been a sort of notion of looking back to a sort of golden age where things were better. So if you talk to other people, you might hear something different. I don't think things have changed much, if at all. Funnily enough, I was reading an anniversary edition of the Grendon newsletter, and I've got the original copy from our archive that was written in 1963 with the residents' accounts, and these accounts talk about the interest that is shown towards them, the respect that they experience from staff and residents. They talk about the sense of hope. They talk about the first time in their lives they were ever able to be authentic. And these seem really important experiences. You also hear exactly the same if you were to talk to residents about their experience of Grendon in, 2020 or 2021 or whenever. You hear a very similar account.
And why would you want it to be any different, given that they're all factors that are associated with health, psychological health and well-being, aren't they? Being able to live a more authentic life and to have a sense of hope.
Yes, yes.
Mm. I think I noticed some changes. I agree with you about the kind of experience, because I visit Grendon, not infrequently, and it always feels the same in just the way that you described. If I go to a large group, then it's all very familiar. So, in a way, I think you're right that the actual practice probably hasn't changed very much, and those kind of qualities of care and concern that you were describing are still the same. But I can remember, because I used to work at Grendon as well some 20 years ago.
I remember, yes.
And previously I'd worked almost entirely within the health service, and I can remember being absolutely shocked by not the quality of the practice, but the quality of the record keeping and the report writing. And I think there's been a significant improvement in that kind of activity since then. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, I suppose. Now you mentioned that, I think you are right in the observation. I think that we, over the last 20 years, have had a clearer set of standards we've had to work within. And one of those, has been the need to have a more systematic way of evidencing change, of reporting on people, of making clinical formulations. So I think there's a probably more structured approach to some of that. So yes, I think there probably have been some improvements in that area. We also now mandate, if that's the right word, supervision of the staff. I think when I joined, it was probably a sort of an activity where people we didn't always provide it as systematically and rigorously as we should have done. We do now, and part of that I think is because we have some very helpful, I believe, quality standards. We are audited again just every couple of years. So yes, I think there have been some developments which I think have been helpful.
Some people might think this way of treating people in prison is only possible because you're cherry picking those who are psychologically minded, those who are interested in growing emotionally, people who wouldn't have been a problem in any part of the prison system. Is that a fair reflection of who ends up coming to your service?
I would say that for some people who come to us, yes, they are absolutely at a position, at a stage in their lives that they really want to make a change and to take advantage of what's on offer within Grendon's and all the offer. They absolutely want to do that. That would apply to some. I would agree with that. And I think to make it work, yeah, you have to have a sort of people with different experiences, different backgrounds, different stages in their life, different attributes, and so on and so forth. Absolutely, we do. There are also a number of a lot of my residents have had very problematic times, experiences in prison, and before they come to prison, they, you know, high risk. A lot of them would have what you might call personality disorders, or certainly very problematic, what sort of complex needs. Yes, I think there is something about making sure that people we get, people who come to Grendon, are at a stage where they can use therapy and not maybe be harmed by it or misuse it. Doesn't mean we cherry pick. Well, to an extent, we have to be confident that the people we have in therapy will not find experience harmful or unhelpful. However, if the question is, do we take people who are low risk, who lack complexity, and have a few psychological needs? Absolutely, we don't. And that's very clear from our sort of research and evidence base. I think maybe what typifies some of the men we work with at the country stage in their life where they really want to make a change, a difference to their lives. And perhaps that typifies men, typifies those who come to us. So yes, I think it would be gung-ho of us to sort of say, yeah, we will work with, you know, people who are, you know, all people based psychopathic or severe personality disorder. That wouldn't work. So we have to have some pragmatism in our approach. So yes, I don't know if that answers your question or if I waffled too much.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's what I was looking for, really.
We've touched upon, at least you've spoken about, your residents' enthusiasm for authenticity and honesty, and how that becomes an intrinsic part of the practice of the Grendon experience. It contrasts somewhat with what's often the experience of people in prisons, of wanting or needing to maintain a hard shell to protect themselves. What do you think is the process of encouraging men to relinquish that hard shell?
First of all, I would say that it's really striking that the way men understand change at Grendon is exactly as you say, David. There is a sense of being able to be genuine and authentic. And that's hugely important to people in a way that I never really understood when I first joined. And this idea of being vulnerable, as in being able to be honest about how they're feeling and their emotions and their fears and so on, and to show emotion, it really, really important to people. Really important issue of vulnerability and change being inextricably linked to people is something that stands out. The second part of your question about what allows that to happen, I think where people have relationships that are mutually supportive, where they're a sense of being like-minded in terms of their experiences, and a sense of trust meaning that people they work with, people in their therapy group, have a similar desire to change and a similar desire to be authentic, I suppose, where there's safety and where there are mutually supportive relationships. Those things are really important in enabling residents to become more authentic. And in particular, what residents will say to us is that the relationships they have with members of staff are really central in trust and in being able to form bonds with people in the past they would struggle to. They will say that perhaps one of the most important things in that process is relationships with officers are pivotal in that process. So yes, those things seem very important, David.
That's really helpful, because what we're very keen to understand from all of the interviews we're doing really is what are the things that might be transferred to the benefit of other prison situations. So the question to you, I suppose, is what do you think of the Grendon experience or the Grendon practice might usefully be implemented in a mainstream prison wing?
That's such an important question. I think it's such a difficult question to answer as well in some ways. I think getting back to Naomi's question, Grendon in a sense is lucky in that those who come to us want to make it work, okay? They're part of their point in their lives, rather, where they want to be able to make a difference. And so they come to us with a sense of hope and a sense of belief in what the process will give them tangible. So I think that having a very clear sort of set of people come to us with hope and they know what it's about. They know what the product is. And I think that's really helpful. It isn't just a prison where they'll get locked up and do time. It's somewhere where there's something meaningful. So I think being able to sort of cultivate a sense of meaning and purpose is really important. I know a lot of prisons are doing that, as we know. The idea of having a rehabilitative culture and environment is now central to a lot of prisons. And I think that's a really important and valuable process.
I wonder if we're diminishing the role of safety, because I think, you know, ultimately we're talking about the prison service having an aspiration to become trauma-informed, but really what that means is about the provision of psychological safety, doesn't it? How you know, there's nothing without the safety. And I wonder if there's a, I suppose it seems almost like taking it for granted, whereas I think it's actually really hard work to create a feeling of safety for people in prison, both for not just for the people, residents in prison, but also staff. So it feels a little bit like taking it for granted when I think there must have been a lot of really hard work gone into creating that sense of safety within Grendon.
Yes, I think you're right. The safety is hugely, hugely important. So creating safety is one thing that drives people to A, to come to us, and secondly, to maintain that safety. And how does that happen? How does Grendon enable that safety to be created? I think one of the things that we have are lots of systems in place where people come together as a group and don't become fragmented or don't become disjointed. There's a sense of cohesiveness. And the cohesiveness for me is because there is a sense of sort of shared purpose. There's a sense of sort of shared vision, if you want. I know these things, those concepts are hard to translate to other prisons, but in a sense of giving people an experience where they can work together to achieve something means that you don't get a sense of sort of fragmentation, which can lead to hostility and conflict. And also people getting to know each other, you know, people get to know each other really well. When that happens, you know, you tend to find, don't you, that once you get to know each other, usually the desire to hurt or harm somebody diminishes. I think that's really important. And also, you know, there is something about when people feel proud of genuinely engaged in the experience, they will behave responsibly. You know, when you've got some genuine systems in place where people can make decisions, become involved, make a difference, and take ownership, people will have a sense of belonging and attachment to the organisation. People have a huge sense of attachment to Grendon. They behave responsibly. And I think that staff support and supervision are really important. Working in prison is a difficult experience. I think we can all acknowledge that. And I think that being able to have systems in place where staff are supervised and supported, for us, I think that's really important. Something maybe which, you know, I mean, I know supervision is something which everybody involved in interventions and other services also has. So, but I think something that for us is really important.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think when you're working in a specialist service, there can be a tendency to disparage efforts and say, well, it's easy for you to do it in your service because you've got loads of extra staff or you're doing these interventions. And yet I think what you're highlighting is some of the softer, less tangible elements of culture which could be focused on more greatly throughout the system without necessarily incurring the costs that I think people become fearful of.
Someone we spoke to recently described how in 4 years in prison, she'd never been addressed by her first name. So she was always addressed either by her second name, which was shouted at her, or simply as inmate, which was also shouted at her. I imagine right from the very beginning, the practice is different at Grendon.
It is. And that's, it is different. And I would say that the use of first name terms is really important. It's really important in shaping culture. I would also say that, you know, the residents behave in ways which are also very respectful and supportive of each other, but also staff. So there's a sort of culture of mutual respect and the antagonisms which you may see elsewhere, those antagonisms are reduced to an extent at Grendon because of the opportunities we have for people to, you know, work alongside each other and collaborate in shared activities and all the things we've just been talking about. But yes, little things like introductions and a handshake on reception, really important. You know, walking through the, getting off the bus and having someone shake your hand, a prison officer introducing him or herself by their first name. You've asked about things that would work in other prisons. Well, I'm sure that would work. And it has a huge impact on shaping the new residents' understanding of what the organisation will be like and what to expect. And it's something they'll talk about, you know, that's shocking. And, you know, first name terms, likewise, really simple to implement and has a profound impact on people's behaviour. So, yes, you are right. It's simple to implement and has a disproportionate impact on culture.
I agree. And it's probably worth us also just saying for the listeners that Jerry hasn't just become silent and we're not just ignoring her and not asking her. She's had to dip out to take a telephone call. So that's why Richard's answering all of the questions that we're asking.
He's doing very well at it. And you've just given a very good description, really, of how important it is for people to know that they've been seen, because there's nothing more depersonalizing than just being shouted at or addressed as you there or inmate. And we know how these really, what appear to be quite slight incidents, can make a tremendous difference to somebody's engagement right at the beginning. Just moving on again, so Grendon is a very nice, secure, safe place. We've been talking about that. How do your residents cope when they move on to a mainstream prison?
I think a lot of the work we do with them is to plan for their progression. Over the years, when I first started at Grendon, there wasn't really a place that you'd naturally want to send them on to. But now with the advent of sort of psychologically informed planned environments and pipes and progression sites, it's much more useful to have somewhere where you can give sort of like a handover and develop a relationship with the people that they're going to be moving on to. And so that's really helpful for us to have so many more rehabilitative culture within so many prisons that, you know, other prisons have changed dramatically as well, which is reassuring, really. And they'll often keep in touch, the residents will often keep in touch afterwards, and then they become sort of clusters of them in prisons. And so they'll develop a relationship with a particular prison and then they'll write back and say, oh, this is really good. And so other people will try to go. So they often become a sort of a support for each other when they move on. And in some of the open prisons, so we had in Shepton Mallet, when that was open, we had a sort of a TC support group, which was really helpful. And the men, you could just go, it was almost like a drop-in, but they were really mutually supportive in this group. And then, of course, Shepton Mallet closed. And so that sort of group moved itself to Low Hill, where a lot of our residents had moved on to. So it was really nice for them to have that. And then they almost know when somebody's coming from Grendon, they usually welcome them and make them, help them settle in, really. And we maintain a contact with that group as well. So we're trying to develop that into other places. But the residents themselves will often look out for their peers, and even if they didn't know them, or sometimes they didn't get on well together in Glendon, they'll often still support them when they move on somewhere else, because they'll understand that sort of feeling of moving on. When I went to Layhill recently, one of our residents had written me a sort of a PowerPoint to give to residents that are moving on about how they could prepare for moving on. So it was really helpful. So I've passed that on to Spring Hill Prison as well, our local open prison, so people can help prepare, because it is a big step transitioning from one prison to another. We're all aware of that. When we move, we know how that's unsettling. So we try to prepare them.
Community spirit, doesn't it, of wanting to support people when they also make that transition. We've spoken a lot about kind of the impact that a TC can have on residents' well-being, but I wondered whether you think that working in a therapeutic community can contribute to the well-being of staff as well.
There's a lot of things in place, isn't there, for within a prison, within Glendon, to support staff, so I guess that helps their well-being, and it's them using all those processes.
I was just thinking about that, because I think it is a very difficult place to work, a very difficult place that the staff have to hear and have to absorb a lot of the trauma of the residents themselves, and the process of taking part in a therapy group facilitating it is very traumatic. But I think there is and of course that can lead to some tensions and divisions and conflicts between people, especially where they develop quite, you know, sometimes very strong, you know, strong feelings or attachments towards residents, and in the process of being in a therapy group, you will bring very strong feelings for members of staff, both positive and negative. But I think what we do have is a culture of reflection and openness in the staff team. So we have a culture of openness in the staff team where people feel as part of the process is, you know, I can be honest with my colleague about how I see him or her. I can be honest with him or her when I see that a boundary might have been broken, or when I see them becoming too angry or whatever towards the resident. There's a culture where people can give feedback and don't see that as somehow injurious or harmful or unhelpful. It's just part of the process. It's part of the process that we need to be open with each other. So, and that is very healthy. And I think that in itself can really contribute towards well-being.
You seem to be talking about the staff also being able to be authentic. You know, that's been really highlighted from your discussions about the residents, but that openness and transparency really is, you're also talking about authenticity amongst the staff, aren't you? And that has to be healthier than trying to pretend to be something that you're not experiencing.
And I think just as it's Glendon isn't for every person in the prison service in terms of people in prison, it's not for all the staff either. It's just not. Some people will really thrive in that environment, and some people, if their sort of usual way of being is to be in power and to sort of hold that power, they might find it really difficult to be challenged by a resident about something they've said or how they've come across to them. And so, you know, to sit in a room, as Richard said, and I was smiling because I thought, of course, you can't remember, imagine now sitting in a room of 50 odd people, because it's been nearly a year since we've been allowed to do that. But to sit in a room and somebody challenge you about how you might have come across to them is very difficult. And we have to sort of contain our feelings when that happens to us. And then we use all the processes that are there. So we'd always debrief after any group or any community meeting. And we have supervision, we have reflective practice, we have sensitivity where we talk to each other about how the work's affecting us. So we have a number of processes and we have to use them. And sometimes we'll find things are happening within the community are being mirrored within the staff team, or what's happening in the staff is being mirrored within the community. So if there's tension within the staff team, we'll often see that being mirrored in the community, and we're trying to work out which way is it coming. Is it coming from us or is it coming from them? So we do have to be able to do that. And that takes a lot more courage to me to challenge a member of staff than it does to challenge a resident at times, but we have to do it, because if we don't do it, then the whole ethos is gone, really.
Therapeutic communities seem to really embody the spirit of agape, that sense of a loving, compassionate community. Is this something that's openly spoken of in Glendon, or does this remain a no-no even in Glendon?
When I thought about that question, what reminded me of was a leaving meal we had for an officer who was leaving. And the officer had been there for many years, and he was leaving to go to another prison. And the residents organised a community leaving meal for him. So he had a meal, but then they set up a room with pictures of things of him, you know, poems they'd done about him, all sorts of things in this room. And then they gave speeches. And a man had come that evening because he was moving to the wing, so he'd come for his sort of joining meal, and he came and witnessed this. And I often looked to him during this evening to see what on earth he's making of this. But literally every man in that wing spoke to Paul about the impact he's had on them, and how moved they were, and a lot of them were in tears. They talked about, they said, "We love you," you know, to say that to a prison officer, and for men to say that to another man, you know, it was really powerful. And often those leaving meals, the same when the residents are moving on, they'll tell, you know, for them to be able to say that to each other, and they'll often say afterwards, you know, "I've never said that to another man, I've never said that publicly to anybody," but it's really a genuine thing. And I don't think we've ever used that term, but they see it in action all the time, that they're able to actually voice emotions that they would never have voiced before, especially because they're probably very much more used to expressing anger, and they would be more comfortable doing that in some ways, but they somehow get swept along when one person does it, that enables someone else to say it. But for them to be able to say that, because they'll often then say, "Oh, I spoke to my family and they noticed what a difference in how I speak to them and how I can express my emotions to them," so they can be really you know, it enables them to do something they haven't been able to do for many reasons, you know, possibly when they were younger, that was how they were sort of, that's what they saw around them, that people didn't say that. And any generations, not many generations ago, you know, men weren't able to really express their emotions. And so it's changing that culture, really.
Jerry's right. The leaving events that I've been to are absolutely staggering with the openness, the residents and support they show towards the person who's leaving, and the sense of gratitude and concern is just profound. And you also see elements of that in our in our wing meetings, where at times you will have up to, you know, 40 or 50 people in there, and staff and residents alike, and there'll be at times where some really sensitive material is discussed and processed to do with loss, or to do with trauma, or to do with somebody's distressing parts of their past. The level of being able to just allow people to show grief and distress without needing to intervene, but just being able to capture that and to allow it and to support people is staggering when you think about the backgrounds and the, I suppose, the antisocialness of our residents. But being able to support each other in the most intimate parts of their lives is a staggering phenomena, which for me, when I experienced that, it surprised me. It still makes you think there's something about the process that is, you know, gets back to a genuine and authentic. So I don't answer your question, Naomi, but maybe to an extent, yes, it does capture that agape-ness.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you certainly can have a sense of the preciousness of those experiences, which I think, you know, does embody that.
And I think another time we see it is after our small groups, the community comes together for feedback. And if anybody's done therapy outside, you know, and then imagine that you'd go and join another couple of groups and listening to what they've been talking about. I mean, that's quite a phenomenon, really. But you'd often see somebody would feedback a group and say, "Oh, Paul had been talking about the death of his mother and how upset he felt about that." And you'd see people sort of perk up around the room and think, okay. And then as they were all going out, somebody, you'd see people going to him and putting their arm around his shoulder from another group, maybe from, you know, they link to each other. And I think that's the real benefit of a therapeutic community, is that they're there together all day and all evening. And it makes such a difference that if someone is a bit down, they'll give them space, but then they'll go and check on them and they'll keep an eye on them. And I did a peer review once at a day community. So these people were just there really for a few hours during the day. And a woman had been there in the morning and was desperately upset, really, really upset. And she was supposed to be leaving at lunchtime, but she was so upset she didn't leave. And then so they, you know, the community sort of rallied around her and she settled in the afternoon. And then I left and she left. We all left, went our own way. And then later on, I went shopping and I saw her in Sainsbury's and I thought, well, that woman has gone through so much today, so much distress. But now she's had to come home, do her shopping and go home, presumably, and cook a meal and whatever else she had to do in the evening. Whereas the men haven't done that work and just be there. They can be with people around them to support them, which is a massive thing to have. And it's a real gift to have, you know, if you're doing therapy, to be able to be in a place where you're not having to worry. And some of them do. Some of them would have to go out of a group and they might be cooking that day or doing jobs. But, you know, they haven't got that same pressure. It's a great opportunity for them to be able to rest a bit afterwards, because it's very exhausting for them as well to express things they've never expressed before and explore some of, you know, they take so much courage to go to places that are so painful for them, to revisit things they've done and things they've had done to them.
I remember Mark Morris, who also used to work at Grenda, describing it once as therapy on an industrial scale, because you'd have, what, I don't know how many guys you have there at the moment, 220. So the idea of over 200 men doing therapy every day is remarkable and probably unique. So just thinking about yourselves, I can remember some of the details of what guys used to tell us from 20 years ago. You've been doing this for 20 years and you listen to some very powerful stories and some, you know, quite horrific accounts of offences, I imagine. How do you look after yourselves? How do you retain your own resilience and clearly your own enthusiasm?
Well, for me, it's using all the processes that are there and, you know, using supervision and sensitivity meetings and processing it. And sometimes I might do something, say for in an afternoon, I might be reading a file about somebody and think, you know, that's really awful. Sometimes for me, reading it is harder than hearing somebody give me an account. And so I would usually just go out and do something different, just go and talk to somebody. And there's always somebody in a community that you could have a chat to or lighten the mood with and have a laugh with. And, you know, there's it's not all extreme and argument and aggression. There's often a lot of fun in the community as well. And so, you know, we have to keep ourselves safe by having a balance, I think, and not sort of getting too drawn into it all the time so that you're overwhelmed by it.
Richard?
Good question. I think there's some question that allows me and allows people to voice, you know, feelings and voice what's going on for you in a way that is, well, yes, allowed. So I mean, that's one of the things. So I think that, you know, being able to be open about the experience and the impact on you is part of the culture, and it's just seen as part of the process that, you know, you're going to get bothered by the work, and that allows you to be able to sort of make sense of what's going on for you. And, you know, in my position, you know, you're working alongside senior colleagues who all have, I think, the same, you know, the same hopes and goals in mind, which is to, you know, run a prison which is safe and very decent and has a role in changing people's lives. What keeps me going? I think I still see what happens there as, I don't take it for granted. I think it needs to be worked on. It. So when it does happen and continues to work and help people and change people's lives, it's still something which I know how difficult it is to achieve that, and the fact that, you know, the fact that it has some really important outcomes still means a lot for me. So I guess that's probably one way I keep going.
Well, certainly one of the things that keeps me going in the job is seeing the changes in people. So you get to know people over 3, 4, 5 years and you see massive changes and they see the changes as well. And somebody got in touch with me the other day on Twitter, who'd been in prison in Grendon some years ago, and he'd been asking me a question about psychopathy. And then he got back to me again and then said, oh, how are you? Because it must be really hard for you. You know, even though you're a therapist, it must be really hard for you in this time. And I thought, you know, for him to even think about that just sort of shows the quality of the relationship, really, that he'd even think to ask how I was and genuinely be interested as well. So I think we do build really strong relationships with people, and you see them, and you see that you get to know their families really well, and you can see people going back to their families and back to a life they should have had, really, in lots of ways. And so that's what keeps me going, really. And people get in touch years later, just out of the blue, and just tell you how they're getting on, and then you might not hear from them again for years again, but it's always nice to hear. That's really positive. Or somebody will say, people when they come into the assessment unit will say, oh, I met so-and-so in the prison, and he said I should come here. Do you remember him? You know, and I usually do, because you get to know people really well. But they, again, will be just the fact that somebody is talking about Grendon somewhere else and encouraging people to come. And in this case, this man was talking about someone who sort of had to be deselected from Grendon and removed from Grendon. But he still encouraged this man to come and said, you know, I think this will be really good for you. So even though people think it wasn't right for them, or it wasn't the right time in their sentence, or for whatever reason it wasn't right for them, they wouldn't stop someone. They'd say to someone else, well, I think you'd do well there, though, even if I couldn't, type of thing.
Well, that's really an interesting point, actually. The number of residents who refer themselves, who get referred to us, who've been encouraged by the enthusiasm of people, ex-Grendon men, including those people who've been, you know, who hasn't worked that well for them, who we think may have failed, who we think haven't been helpful, but they will often find it's those men who will have really encouraged and supported others in coming to us. And that's always, it's always good to see, isn't it, that? You say, so-and-so asked you to come here. Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, he said it was great. He got that out of it. So, you know, that's always interesting.
It's been a really nice interview today, because what you can really hear from both of you is this, like, real passion and zest for the work, your enthusiasm, even kind of like all these years on, really comes out when you talk about the work that you're doing and how important it is. And that's been really, really nice and enjoyable.
Yeah, I think you can see how there's quite a positive feedback loop that you're a part of, really, which must be very sustaining.
It made me really miss the wing meetings, talking about them, when you think, gosh, it is nearly a year since we've been in one. Maybe do really miss it. And other days you think, oh, this is the last place I want to be, when you know there's conflict or you're not sure what's going to come up. But actually, it's really made me miss it. We realise that it is nearly coming up a year, isn't it, since we've been able to do a lot of our day-to-day work.
Yes. But I don't think we're being overly sentimental. My recollection of working in Grendon and other TCs is that one would have long periods of feeling very enthusiastic and pleased about the work, and then a sudden trough where everything seems to go wrong and you feel rotten about the work.
No, that does happen, and it would normally then be somebody else that would sort of make you buoyant again. But yeah, the communities do go through difficult times, and there might be compromise within the community. There might be drugs or phones in the community, so it's very shut down. So that's tough when you're trying to work through that. But we always know, because we've seen it often enough, that it will come back up again. So we have to hold the hope until it does.
I just want to ask one last question, because Twitter has been alight with rumours of a large new prison being built in the grounds. Have you been consulted about that at all, involved in any discussions?
I think there is a public consultation process about that. You know, there's a need to expand prisons, and I think Grendon has been muted as a site where we potentially have a Category C prison. And yeah, there is a sort of, you know, a public consultation process which we're all part of. There's also lots of anxieties about this, which is interesting, and I wondered if I'd missed the point somewhat. So I think in some ways it gives perhaps an opportunity for Grendon's good practice to, you know, to shape the way the prison can be set up and structured, such as it has. That relationship with the open prison across the road is very symbiotic, and we shape their culture, and I'm sure they shape us to an extent. So, yes, it's something which we go through a sort of a wider consultation process. Who knows what would happen, but I know there's mixed views there. I would see it as more something we perhaps could be an asset to us. So let's see what happens. I don't know about you, Jerry.
Great excitement, because we've always wanted to see CAPFIS and Nexus, so we could send people and we could be sort of part of their journey to there and then to an open prison. It's an ideal pathway for us. I was quite surprised that there was sort of some anxiety about it, but no, I think it's a great thing. But we haven't been consulted any more than anybody that lives in the area has been consulted. But I think it'd be a positive thing.
Well, good luck with the progress of that, and indeed with everything else that's been going on for the past year, and it looks as if it's going to continue for a little while. Yeah.
But thanks ever so much for coming on and giving us so much of your time. It's been really generous of you, and really enjoyed chatting with both of you. Thank you.
Nice to talk to you as well.
Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
See you.
Really enjoyed that. Really nice conversation. It's so lovely to talk to people working within the justice system who are clearly really passionate about their work and really care about the people that they're providing the service to.
Yeah, they're both tremendously experienced. And to me, they represent a transformation in the prison service, because 20 years ago, when they both sort of started, it wasn't the most fashionable thing to be a forensic psychologist working in a therapeutic community. In fact, it was mainly viewed with disdain from many other psychologists in the prison service. So I think they've both done remarkably well in maintaining their enthusiasm and passion for the work.
Yeah, it really shone through. It was excellent.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music. You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.